Welcome to a new series on this channel, Masters of Austrian Economics. I will be outlining the core ideas of Austrian economics through its most important thinkers. I will not be looking at their lives, which is to say, biography is not my concern. If you are interested in further information on this, the Mises Institute website has many resources for free. Let us waste no further time. In this video, we will look at the ideas of Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school. In 1871, he wrote a book called The Principles of Economics and is credited with the subjective theory of value and, together with William Stanley Jevons and Leon Walras, ushering in the marginal revolution which effectively ended classical economics. However, Menger's ideas were a lot deeper than this, and sometimes he is not given due attention even by those steeped in Austrian theory. Menger's economics are grounded in one central principle, that all things are subject to the law of cause and effect. All his insights flow from this. Thus, a good is defined as a useful thing employed in the satisfaction of human needs. The designation of something as a good depends on this causal relationship. If any of the sufficient conditions no longer apply, say the need is gone or the knowledge that the thing can be used to fulfill that need, the thing ceases to be a good. Menger distinguishes between first-order goods, what modern economists call consumer goods, which are employed directly in the satisfaction of needs, and second-order, third-order, fourth-order goods, today called intermediary goods and raw materials, which are higher up the supply chain. For example, bread fulfills the human need for hunger, but requires flour, a second-order good, and wheat, a third-order good, to be produced. These higher orders of goods are the means of production. Menger points out that if the first-order good ceases to be a good, let us say if the need for it disappears, then the second-order and third-order goods also cease to be goods. In other words, in this scenario, assuming no other uses for flour or wheat are available, if bread ceases to be a good, then so do flour and wheat. In other words, the value of the wheat depends on its ability to be transformed into flour, which in turn depends on its ability to be transformed into bread. The demand for flour would collapse if there was no demand for bread. Now, this may seem like a super obvious point, but it is still not grasped even by neoclassical economists who maintain a cost-based production theory, let alone classical economists who maintained the labour theory of value. Menger correctly shows how the chain of value starts with the fact that people value the first-order good for its ability to satisfy their needs. Producers value higher-order goods only for their ability to satisfy their need to produce lower-order goods. The causal relationship starts at the bottom of the supply chain, at the consumer level, and not at the top. To develop his theory of value, Menger makes a number of further observations. First, concrete needs diminish with each act of their satisfaction. More on this in a moment. Second, goods have discrete units of specific quantities. That is, it makes no sense to talk about any particular good in the abstract, but their employment for specific uses in specific quantities. Again, I'll elaborate on this shortly. Third, goods only attain an economic character if they are scarce. Menger uses the example of Robinson Crusoe, alone on an island with access to a spring of water. He employs the water in many different ways, but as long as the supply of water is seemingly unlimited, water itself is not an economic good. However, imagine now that he is restricted, for some reason, to only 100 units of water per day. Now he must economize and make decisions about how best to allocate that water because it is now scarce. Next, Menger shows how the preference scale of a single individual might work. Here, the good on the left with Roman numeral number 1 is the highest concrete need, and the one on the right, Roman numeral 10, is the lowest concrete need. In this case, the highest need is food, the lowest need is for diamonds or jewellery. The concrete need for food is 10, so let us pretend that the individual eats a sandwich, now the need is 9, and maybe a bowl of French fries, now the need is 8, let's say also an ice cream, and now the need is 7. The individual also has a need for many other things, clothes, hygiene, health, and so on. To use Menger's own example, this individual has a need for tobacco, but this is less than his need for food. In fact, the individual won't use tobacco until other needs have been satisfied. In other words, the need for food, clothing, hygiene, and beer must be below 6 before this individual will seek to satisfy the tobacco need. Menger is making 2 points with this. First, that even within the preference scales of a single individual, the value of any given good may change relative to how many of their needs have been satisfied. In this case, the first unit of tobacco is valued more highly than the 6th unit of food. The second point is that every person has different preference scales, so maybe another person's looks like this. You can see their need for tobacco is lower and their need for clothing is higher than the first person's. This is essential to grasp. Every individual has different scales of preference and they are constantly subject to change. The same person may have a different scale of preference in the morning than they do in the evening. Menger also wants to show how there is nothing intrinsic in a given good that produces its value, but only its employment to satisfy distinct needs in specific quantities. He uses wheat as an example. Let us pretend there is an isolated farmer. He produces a certain quantity of wheat. He employs the first portion of this wheat to feed himself and his family. He uses the second portion to help maintain their health. The third portion is used to sow seeds for the next harvest. The fourth portion is used to make whiskey. The fifth to help feed his cattle, and anything left over to feed his pets. Let's pretend he uses 100 units of wheat to do this. It is clear that if he had only 90 units of wheat, then he would employ it to satisfy the first 5 wants first. There is nothing left for the pets, and the cattle only get 5 units now. Let's reduce the stock of wheat further to 70 units. Now he must also cut the production of whiskey and the feeding of the cattle, because these are less important to him than feeding his family and growing more wheat for next season. Exactly the same good, wheat, is valued differently according to which need it is satisfying. It is clear then that what is valued is not the good itself, but the need which is being satisfied. Humans value the satisfaction of their needs and come to value goods only as a result of this causal relationship. There's nothing intrinsic to the wheat which produces the value scale of this farmer. And we can see this by substituting its various different uses with other goods which fulfill the same needs. The substitution of the goods does not change the farmer's value scale. He still wants to feed his family before he makes alcoholic drinks or feeds the cattle and the pets. The fact that it is wheat or corn or pumpkins or any other good does not matter. Menger does go on to say that the qualities of particular goods do matter in how people value them, but there is usually some secondary need being satisfied. For example, if we take 4 different types of food, as well as satisfying the basic need for hunger, they may also satisfy a secondary need for enjoyment. This particular person gets greater enjoyment from eating ice cream than from eating pumpkin. Since they fulfill the same food need, it is likely they'll plump for ice cream over pumpkin if given the choice. But what if they are more hungry? They may opt to sacrifice some enjoyment for more fulfillment of the food need by getting a pie instead of the ice cream. Of course, in reality, there may be other needs to consider, the health need, for example. In fact, there is no limit to how complex this can get, and people in the real world do weigh up many complex variables when making decisions all the time. From these central insights about the nature of value, Menger then builds up a theory of exchange and a theory of prices. He imagines two cowboys, A and B. One has six horses and one cow, and the other has one horse and six cows. The numbers represent the satisfaction of needs. That is, whatever they are using the horses and the cows for. We can see here that in A's case, the sixth cow is not employed in the satisfaction of any needs, and the same in the case of B's sixth horse. Thus, it makes sense for A and B to exchange the cow and the horse. The horse is worth more than the cow to A, and the cow is worth more than the horse to B. So now, after the exchange, more needs are being satisfied on both sides. But now look at cow 5 and horse 5. Are these two animals being employed to the maximum satisfaction of needs? Again, it is mutually beneficial for the cowboys to exchange. Now both of our cowboys have maximized the satisfaction of their needs. Is it worth swapping the fourth cow for the fourth horse? Since both of them satisfy the same number of needs, then there's nothing to be gained from this exchange, and both cowboys can go their own way. But what if our cowboy cannot find someone to trade exactly two cows for two horses? Well, this is how the need for indirect exchange and commodity money arises. Once commodity money is established, the cowboy can sell the cows to a trader in exchange, let's say for gold, and then go to a rancher and exchange that gold for horses. But how do prices form? Well, Menger outlines how prices form chiefly through competition, whether between buyers or sellers. Let us pretend there is only one horse up for auction and four cowboys bidding on the horse. Here we can see that B has the greatest need for horses, whereas A has the least need, followed by C and D. C, however, has the most money and A has the least. Each participant in this auction needs to weigh up how much they want the horses versus their need to hold money for its potential other uses. Before bidding even starts, A decides that he doesn't need another horse that much, and so he withdraws. A fifth horse is not even worth one gold piece to A. B decides that he really needs that first horse, and so he goes right in and bids all his gold pieces. It's that important to him. At this point, D withdraws. He cannot bid higher than three. And besides, even if he could, he decides he would prefer to keep his total stock of money than buy a third horse anyway. So it comes down to C. He can buy a fourth horse and still have one gold coin left over. Is the fulfillment of 20 needs worth four gold coins to him? This, again, is entirely subjective. It may be, it may not be. Maybe this guy is really nasty and would derive satisfaction from screwing over B. If he withdraws, the price of the horse is 3. If he bids, the price will be 4. And so the price of this horse is found on the market. We know it's going to be 3 or 4. Of course, the final price can be affected by how many horses there are and how many bidders there are. More horses will likely mean a lower price per horse. More bidders will likely mean a higher price per horse. And so we can see how the law of supply and demand intermeshes with the subjective theory of value and the law of diminishing marginal utility. Karl Menger was the first person to build a completely integrated, consistent, and logical subjectivist economic theory. His many insights are the bedrock on which Austrian economics is built. Now get out.
And a very special thanks to Stetson F. Lionel, The Ambivalent Onion, Christopher Scholholm, The Crimson Satyr, Chris, Kieran Haywood, Mr. A.M. Swainson, Radical Liberation, The Binary Surfer, Tragic Vision, Bailey and Aurora, Toyotomi Ami, Holy Spatula, Alexander, Froggy, Splice, Buck Egypt Society, Michael Meir, Jay Greenriver, Michael Tynan, Heronius Napalm V, Vincenzo Rapio, and Edward Darrow.